This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Anyway, we've got Paul Dabbar, former Undersecretary for Science, in the Energy Department during the Trump administration. Welcome back, Paul Dabbar. I'm reading your article, How the U.S. Turned the Tables on OPEC, in the Wall Street Journal. Now, I confess I did not know that OPEC tried to convince my pal Dan Brouillette, who at the time was Energy Secretary, that they wanted us to, well, not exactly join OPEC, but coordinate with OPEC. I didn't know that. And you're writing in the journal that they wanted us to. So what's up with that? What happened here?
Yeah, Larry, so if you may remember, in the lead up to the COVID crisis, the Russians and the Saudis were beginning to renegotiate their old OPEC Plus deal. And they were about to get into a big market share fight. And the U.S., as you may remember, was very much involved with really trying to, you know, keep the two of them from going after each other. And then COVID hit. And so there was quite a bit of energy diplomacy. And preceding that was the Three Seas Initiative, where you and the president and Secretary Perry and Brouillette, you know, was trying to help Poland and the Baltics and Ukraine to start getting off Russian natural gas long before the, you know, this war. And so there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of energy diplomacy and American energy dominance, right, as the leading producer of crude oil in the world. And as a result of all that leading into COVID, we were very much engaged in the diplomacy. President Trump actually announced the OPEC Plus deal from the White House around the COVID situation, and behind the scenes and even publicly, various oil ministers were saying that they appreciated American leadership and wanted to continue to coordinate with us. And behind the scenes, that's where the offer came in.
I'm going to have to call Brouillette about this, because this is a very interesting sort of, it's one of these little sub stories. In a sense, though, Paul, we were coordinating with them. And it seems to me the Biden administration, with its hostility to fossil fuels, and its hostility, I mean, they've changed our Middle East foreign policy, now favoring Iran instead of Israel, and, you know, insulting the Saudis. They wouldn't even take Biden's calls. I mean, that's a, regardless of how much, you know, that's a big loss, it seems to me. The Saudis, I mean, they may wind up making their own deal with Israel, which is a good thing. The Iranian diplomacy for a new nuclear agreement is probably the dumbest thing, the worst thing I've ever heard. But what's the impact of this on the world price of oil? Because I want to get you, I want you to tell me about the world price of oil. It's stabilized, Paul. It's, you know, it's like 120. It's been running in a range, right? 100, 105, the low end of the range, 120. It's not gone to 150 or 175. So is that going to stay where it is, and what's OPEC's role in that?
Yeah, so as we've talked about before, Larry, back not that long ago, 2 years ago, the U.S. set the price of oil in the world because we became the swing producer of, right, of additional crude. And as a result, we were setting the price of oil for the world because we were the swing producer. That was based on the price of production of crude for shale, primarily in the Permian and the Bakken basins in the U.S., where prices to produce oil had dropped to around $30 to $40 a barrel. And as a result, we were setting the price of oil, which was about the time $50 a barrel, based on American leadership, American production, American exports. So jumping forward, U.S. production dropped during COVID, and because of ESG and some government policies, it hasn't recovered. And that's when the price of oil started moving up. When, you know, gas is, went from 225 in at the election at the turnover in January of 2021 to $5. That's a 70% annualized inflation rate, and it's in, it, it's in part because the U.S. has not recovered for those drivers I just said. And as a result, and then just in the last couple of months, Russia taking more oil off the market, so to speak, because of their invasion, we've shifted tremendous power back to the swing producers, which are now OPEC.
Right. So we're still a little over a million barrels a day short of where we were pre-pandemic. And so therefore, I'm going to argue that has contributed mightily to the increase in the world oil price, regardless of the Ukraine. And Paul, let me add one more thing here. The Energy Department, what is it, the think tank, the energy, what do they call it?
The Energy Information Agency, yeah. Which is the data right. Part of okay. DOE. Yep.
So look, they are putting out, I try to read their reports occasionally, we are undersupplied in gasoline, right? The demand for gasoline has gone up quite a bit, but the stocks, the inventory of gasoline has come down. So we are short, we're undersupplied gasoline, and we're undersupplied oil. Now, I understand Russia and I understand Putin, but aren't those factors contributing, let's say, to $5 of gasoline, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, domestic production not recovering is a primary driver of inflation in the U.S. It's a global
right.
market,
right.
But the U.S., and we proved it, as I laid out in my article, at the bottom of production in the U.S., we were down at 4.9 million barrels a day in 2007. And because of technology, capital, and policies, we went from that low of 4.9 million barrels a day in the U.S. to 12.9 in 2019. That is a monumental jump in production in the U.S. So we have the capability to not only close that million, barrel a day gap, we could do far more than that to fill what's going on both, historically because of U.S. production, but we could fill the gap from Russia too.
So that puts Biden blames Putin for oil and gas prices and inflation, but that's not true. If we weren't undersupplied here at home, right, these prices would be much lower everywhere. They might not have gone back to the lows. You might not be back to $60 a barrel globally. Okay, I get that. You wouldn't be back to 2.25 gasoline, but we wouldn't be where we are now. In other words, I'm just trying to fence off Putin. It is our production shortage here that's killing us.
Yeah, the U.S. should be part of the solution, both for ourselves and for the world. To say that the U.S. doesn't have an impact on global oil prices or gasoline prices is not inaccurate. It is inaccurate, as I kind of laid out in my article about how much we were able to fill the gap for us and the world, over the last decade. And as you may remember, Larry, when we were around D.C., not only were we a million barrels a day up from where we are today, the EIA actually predicted that we were going to be another 2 million barrels on top of that we were heading towards in terms of the U.S. industry.
We were going to 15. We were going to 15 million barrels a day.
Yep, that's right. That's when we were down there.
Right. Can you imagine what that would be like now? I mean, really, and it's going right to the gas at the pump. We're undersupplied, and the Bidens will not deal with that, Paul. They just will not. In other words, I can't stop Putin in the Ukraine. I get that, okay, and I get the embargoes and the threat, but we could be doing so much more at home. Last 45 seconds.
Yeah, Larry, I mean, the 3 million barrel a day gap between where we are today and where we could be, right, based on historical projections.
Right.
That 3 million barrels a day would almost completely cover what the Russians have taken off the global market.
Right. There you go. Paul Debar, former chief scientist at the Energy Department under President Trump. Thank you very much, Paul.